Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Li Hui Zhang, and I'm an assistant professor here at JSGS. It is my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Lars Osberg to you today. Dr. Osberg is Makala Professor and Chair of the Department of Economics at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. He attended Queen's University and the London School of Economics and Political Science as an undergraduate. After 2 years working for the Tanzania Sisal Corporation as a CUSO volunteer, he went to Yale University for his PhD. He has had visiting positions at a number of universities, including Cambridge, New York University. Most recently, during 2009 to 2010, he was senior visiting research fellow at Research on Poverty Alleviation, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and visiting scholar at the Indira Gandhi Institute for Development Research in Mumbai, India. Dr. Osberg has authored numerous books, articles, chapters, reviews, and reports on the extent and causes of poverty and economic inequality, with particular emphasis on social policy. Among other professional responsibilities, he was president of the Canadian Economics Association in 1999 to 2000. As some of you may already know, I'm fortunate enough to have Dr. Osberg as one of my two PhD co-supervisors. Those years have been instrumental for my personal growth. Not only did Dr. Osberg teach me economics, but also he exemplified to me some of the most respected qualities as a teacher and as a scholar. Please allow me to take this opportunity and say that I'm deeply grateful for his kindness and his mentorship. Everyone, please join me in welcoming Dr. Osberg to Saskatchewan.
Thank you, Li Wei, for those very kind words as an introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here in Regina and to be talking about what is, I think, a hugely important topic for our society and for the global society. What I'll be talking about, you can see the title, Instability Implications of Increasing Inequality, Evidence from North America. This paper was initially a conference a paper a couple of years ago, and it's gone through a couple of working paper versions. If you're interested later on, the paper's available, I understand, on the website here, and will be available on my own website. If you're willing to wait long enough, it'll actually come out as a journal article in economic modeling whenever journal articles come out, which tends to be later. And the basic point I want to address, well, I guess we ought to always ought to allow a little bit of time for people who arrive late, and have the first few slides should perhaps have a little bit of motivational force. So, there we go. The World Economic Forum, their analysis of global risks facing the world, not much more elite opinion do you get than that of the sort of the power elite of the global economy. What did they rank as their top five risks in terms of likelihood? Severe income disparity and chronic fiscal imbalances. What did they rank as among their top five risks in 2012? Major systemic financial failure, chronic fiscal imbalances, extreme volatility, i.e. call it economic instability. So at the level of elite opinion and also at the level of grassroots opinion, February 2012 survey of Canadians, roughly 3,000 by ECOS, asked them, which do you think is the biggest threat to the global economy? Overwhelmingly, people chose the responses that the things that really, the dangers really facing the global economy are all about both the growing debt crisis in an advanced economy and the increasing concentration of income and wealth in advanced economies. And so I want to try and argue to you today that these are very much linked issues. that they're inherently linked issues. And it's always been a good practice to have your entire lecture in one slide at some point. And so my entire roadmap for what I'm about to say is basically going to be based around the idea that in the US and Canada, we've seen, well, call it one way or call it the other, it's really the same phenomenon. If different parts of the income distribution grow at different rates, that means inherently that the distribution of income must change, inequality must change. That's both unbalanced growth and changing inequality. So unbalanced growth, the flip side of unbalanced growth is changing inequality. It just has to be. So which way do we want to think about it? Whatever way we want to think about unbalanced growth or changing inequality, this is not a trend that can continue indefinitely into the indefinite future. It cannot be a steady state equilibrium of a market economy. So one of the reasons why we're worried about increasing inequality is because it's a story whose end we don't know. It's got to be going somewhere, but we don't exactly know how this story ends. Now, there was a point in time, back when I first started thinking about income distribution and inequality, when the study of income inequality was denigrated as being about as interesting as watching grass grow, because for a long period of time, from the late 40s to the middle 70s, there just wasn't much change in the quintile shares or decile shares of income in countries like Canada, the US, and the UK. So that if the income distribution is pretty much stable, there's not much going on, that's what you call balanced growth. If there's balanced growth at all different parts of the income distribution, and the distribution of income therefore remains stable over time, then that's a reason why macroeconomic theorists can start to say, well, we can ignore the income distribution. We can think in terms of this balanced growth, steady state growth. We can think in terms of representative agents. That's not the world of today. That's not the world of today, and hasn't been the world that we've experienced for about the last 25 years. So what we have observed instead is very unequal rates of growth at different parts of the income distribution, and therefore changing cross-sectional distribution of income. And my argument is that this creates inherently interacting instabilities, that it creates inherently debt fragilities and the hangovers from debt fragilities in terms of financial crises and their aftermaths. And the question is there something in the economic system that's an automatic stabilizer? One thing, in fact, the only thing that will stabilize the distribution of income in a cross-sectional sense is if all parts of the income distribution start to grow at the same rate. This can happen either because the top end grows more slowly or the bottom end grows more quickly, but what exactly is the economic process that's likely to produce either of those outcomes? I don't actually see any particular automatic economic tendency for the rates of growth of different parts of the income distribution to equalize. And so that implies that we have to be thinking that market mechanisms have at least the possible potential of being inherently unstable or generating interacting instabilities going forward. Now that's the sort of picture we observe from Canada and the United States, but the picture you think of, you can see from the Mexican perspective is quite different. Mexico is a country starting at a different stage of economic development. At a different stage of economic development, you still have room for many structural sort of one-off kind of changes, such as urbanization, such as increasing female labor force participation, such as an expanding role for education. So those changes can produce and do produce substantial growth of income, incomes at the bottom. When you combine that with the political economy of social policies and a credible threat from the hard left, you see the establishment of significant social programs in the Mexican context. So a very different pattern of income distributional change in Mexico. So the question I'm going to be ending up with is, if economic mechanisms can't stabilize growth rates in countries like Canada and the US, can we depend on political economy in some sense to stabilize growth rates, to return us to a balanced growth rate path, and to stabilize the distribution of income? And I should say that at this point that some things won't be in this talk. There's been an enormous amount of research on the distribution of income. On the left, you see a whole bunch of acronyms: LIS, Luxembourg Income Study, ISSP, International Social Survey Program, WVS, World Value Survey, OECD, that's a huge database, World Development Indicators, that's from the World Bank. Those are all examples of the just explosion of comparable international data sets that enable social sciences researchers for the last 15, 20 years to compare nations in terms of their level of poverty and inequality and a whole bunch of other social indicators. So there have been many, many cross-sectional, cross-country comparisons at points in time of the level of economic inequality and its implications for health, for happiness, for crime, for democracy, for economic growth. Then the thing about those that literature is it's always been cross-sectional comparisons, which kind of assumes that those cross-sectional levels are going to be stable over time, right? I want to focus rather on changing levels of inequality within countries over particular countries. Unbalanced growth within countries, not cross-sectional comparisons of levels. Now, on the right panel, that refers to another huge body of literature, which I won't be talking about today, which is based similarly on the expanding tools of labor economists, primarily, in the enormous increase in data sets that survey the population, that initially cross-sectional, more recently panel data sets, which have pretty good answers on a whole bunch of questions regarding what's happening to what I would call the middle 90% of the population. Sample surveys, by their nature, pick up lots more people in the middle 90% of the population than they do in the top 1% tail at the bottom or at the top. And so the many labor economists have spent a lot of time worrying about the impact of things like minimum wages, unions, other institutional changes, changing female labor force participations, homogamy, which is a fancy word for saying that like marry like or not, changing returns to education, changing union density, skill bias and technological change, impacts of demography, all those things, globalization, did I forget globalization? A lot of work has been done on impacts on either hourly wages or annual earnings or whatever for that middle 90% of the distribution. And that's very often useful as a way of understanding how people have changed their position in the distribution of income, how there's been a lot of churning, lots of structural change in labor markets. But I'm going to ignore that for the basic reason that in the end, those changes don't add up to nearly as much. Because we've seen in the change of the top, we've seen a 10 percentage point change in the share of the top 1% of the income distribution in the United States, and nearly as big in Canada. Now that is huge. When the bottom 20% of the income distribution get of the order of 4% of household income, the top 1% have changed their share by 2.5 times the total receipts of the bottom 20%. When we talk about the changing shares of the intermediate quintiles of the income distribution, we're talking about, you know, percentage point here, percentage point there, half a percentage point, that sort of thing. Nothing like as big, an order of magnitude smaller than what's been happening at the extreme top end. So what I'm going to be primarily talking about focuses on the new availability over the last 10, 15 years maybe, returns based on income tax data and a complete census of what's happening at the very top. So my basic argument is that unbalanced growth and increasing inequality are flip sides of exactly the same coin. That what we've seen over the period 1987 to 2007, which is a useful period to look at because after 1988, Canada and the U.S., Canadian professionals could move more easily to the U.S. under the Free Trade Agreement. 2007 was the last year before the financial crisis, so we're kind of comparing peak to peak in the business cycle. You can summarize that period as saying that the incomes of the top 1% of the distribution grew at like 4% per year compounded, and the bottom 80% of the distribution grew at like a half percentage point a year compounding. And there was some little bit of an improvement as you went into the 90th, 95th, 96th percentiles of the distribution, but you're not going far wrong if you think basically about top 1% as having a very different income trajectory from the other 99%. Now, as I've already said, Mexico since 1995 is a very different story with structural changes plus social transfers. And I'm going to argue that in many ways what they've been going through since 1995 is not so very different from the same sort of structural changes that Canada and the U.S. experienced in the post-war period. Now, in the post-war period in Canada, the U.S., and the U.K., when income distribution was stable and people could think that income distribution wasn't something that you had to worry about because it just wasn't changing all that much, so economists didn't have to worry anymore about those old ideas of class conflict and inherent instability of capitalism that had preoccupied economists for the period all the way through from the 1800s through the 1930s, economics as a profession kind of changed its orientation and started focusing much more on steady state equilibrium as an inherent characteristic of a market system. But if we have unbalanced growth, then all those bets are off. I'd argue that the period up to about 1970. Five was kind of a happy accident, where you had a special case of balanced growth, a steady state equilibrium, because it happened to be the case that all parts of the income distribution grew at approximately the same rate. And that a very important component of that stability of the income distribution were the structural reforms instituted in the U.S. In the 1930s as a response to the instability of the Great Depression. Now, if we're going to talk about U.S., Canada, and Mexico, how different are we? Well, we know right off the start, different in population size, different in GDP per capita. But the differences I'm going to focus on. Well, tertiary level education, ages 25 to 64, much higher, of course, at the bottom edge of that range, at the 25 level than at the 64 level. But Canada and the U.S. already well-educated populations, very well-educated populations, in 2009. Not much hope for further improvement from there. Mexico, very different case. Female labor force participation, Canada and the U.S., already very high rates of female labor force participation. Mexico, much, much lower. Still room for improvement. Agriculture, again, still a much larger fraction of the population in Mexico than in Canada or the U.S. Not much room for migration out of rural poverty to affect the distribution of income in Canada or the U.S. anymore. That train has left the station. That's gone. And people here don't quite appreciate typically what a large change in demography has happened in Mexico, as in many other Latin American nations, where the birth rate is essentially halved over the last 25 years. So you had a really structurally huge change in demography. Birth rates were already low in Canada in 1980. Not a whole lot of room to change. So we're different, and we're partly different because of the structural point in the development process. Now, there we go. So what's been happening in Canada and the US? Well, typically people look for the Gini index as a summary measure of income distribution. A good way to think of it is to look at the equivalized after-tax, after-transfer distribution among individuals of household income. And what you observe there are three very different kinds of trends. In Canada, the least inequality, or the bottom line, you see a trend which kind of stable from the mid-80s to the mid-90s. This was a period when rising market income inequality was largely offset by the tax and transfer system. But after 1995, a steady increase in the Gini index of inequality of household income. The U.S. is a solid line in the chart. Pretty steady creep upward in total Gini index of income inequality. Mexico, a different case, much higher inequality to start, rising to 1995, but then descending thereafter. And that trend is characteristic of many Latin American countries. It's not just Mexico. Think about a Gini index of inequality. Think about any summary index of inequality, is that it doesn't tell you which part of the income distribution is changing. Most of the income distribution can remain exactly the same, but the Gini index won't tell you which part is changing over time. So that's why I think it's useful to look at what's been happening to the real income of Canadian households at different percentile points in the income distribution. This table, this figure looks at the 20th, 40th, 50th, 60th, and 80th percentile of the distribution of income. That is to say, what's noticeable to me, that faint line down at the bottom is the 20th percentile of the income distribution. Next to it, the dashed line is the 40th, and the solid line is the median. What's noticeable to me is that here we've got a 76 to 2009, 33-year period, just not much of anything is happening. You get a bit of upward movement at the 60th, and then when you get up to the 80th percentile, there's a bit of an upward trend, particularly over the last little part of the period, over the 2000s. But we have a 33-year period in Canada in which most points in the income distribution just didn't see much action at all in real income. And of course, whether households in the middle part of the income distribution are supplying significantly more hours to the paid labor market over this period, so if anything, overstates their trend in real well-being. It's the whole batch. It's disposable household income. Market income minus taxes plus transfers. If you go say market hourly wages, for example, flat from 1980 on, strong growth in the late 1970s, but flat from about 1980-81. It's not surprising that you're going to find median or average hourly wages, same basic trend. If you draw like a plot of the distribution of hourly wages in 1980 and the distribution of hourly wages in 2005, they overlap almost exactly. So there's a lot of churning going on, individuals moving up, individuals moving down, but the distribution remaining remarkably the same. U.S. In the U.S., they're less shy about reporting the income of the 95th percentile. Canadian Statistics Canada is very shy about being that high in the income distribution. So you can actually see in the orange line at the top the growth at the 95th percentile of the income distribution, and below it you can see the corresponding 80th, 60th, median, 40th, and 20th percentiles of the income distribution. And again, the farther down you go in the distribution, the greater the stagnancy. In real dollar terms, the stability of the income of the person at the household at the 20th percentile of the distribution is just quite dramatic. So what this is telling us is that those changes in the distribution of income that are summarized in the Gini index are not coming from real income changes that are happening at the 20th, 40th, 50th, 60th, or 80th percentile of the income distribution. They're coming from changes that are happening at the top end of the income distribution, and in particular, what's been happening to the top 1% of the income distribution. Now, this I have to thank Mike Veal of McMaster for sharing his data with me. There's also now a database available on the web, the World Top Incomes Database, where you can download this stuff from many, many countries anytime you want. Many people are now familiar with this idea that the top 1% share was very high in the 1920s, plummeted in the 1930s, and as both Canada and the U.S. went into the Second World War, and declined slowly until the 1970s and started to increase dramatically in the 1980s. Now, the red dotted lines are Canada's top 1% income share, and it should be cautioned that this is tax unit data, so it's sensitive to how top-end incomes are treated for tax purposes. In the U.S., closely held corporations of the top 1% do get attributed back to their owners. In Canada, that hasn't been the case, so we're talking about individual income tax returns, the top 1% of individual income tax returns. So we're not able yet to count what's happening to the closely held corporations of that top 1%. There's a research project underway, fields associated with it, to try and figure to decode that. So it may or may not be the case that the Canadian top 1% share is less than the American top 1% share. Now, this is taken from Mike Veal's presidential address. It's lifted straight from his presidential address as published in the Canadian Journal of Economics, and takes it a little bit more up to date. You can see the run-up from 1987 to in the 1980s, rather than extreme right, you can see the run-up in top 1% share, and then the decline corresponding to the financial crisis of 2008. But the bottom two lines are for the share of the top 0.1% and the top 0.0001%. And you can see that the top 0.1% and the top 0.0001% seem to be starting to recover very nicely from the temporary shock of the Great Recession. And so they're back on the previous trajectory. So, now, the thing I want to just remind everybody is that an income share is actually a ratio. The income share of the top 1% is the average income of the total incomes of the top 1%. Divided by the total incomes of everybody, which is incomes of the other 99% plus their incomes, right? And a change in a ratio is always a tricky thing to interpret, because a ratio can go up, either because the numerator goes up or because the denominator goes down. And the ratio can change over time because either the numerator grows faster or because the denominator grows slower. So if we're thinking about changing income shares, we might want to ask the question, where has the action actually been in income shares? Is it the changing numerator that's driving these trends, or is it the changing denominator that's driving these trends? And the next slide is actually lifted from a paper by Saez and Piketty in a book by Atkinson and Piketty. For some unaccountable reason, they just buried this way in the appendix. But I think it's their most interesting chart out there, because it presents the real income of the bottom 99% and the top 1% of the U.S. from like the 1917 up to 2000 and something. And on the left-hand side, with the top, the dark top line, is the average income of the bottom 99%. And on the right-hand side is the scale for the average income, average real income of the top 1%. And so what you'll notice is that they're kind of moving together for the period up to about 1940, when the U.S. gets involved in the second, 40-41, when the U.S. gets involved in the Second World War. And then the top line just scoots up, right? And that's the average incomes, average real incomes of the bottom 99%. Now, the average real incomes of the top 1% aren't declining. In fact, they've got a very modest upward trend to them throughout this period. Now, if we flip back, we can see that that's exactly the period when their income share fell, and fell precipitously. But their income share, the income share of the top 1%, didn't fall because the top 1% were in any sense absolutely worse off. It's because everybody else was much better off and growing much more rapidly. Income shares, changing income shares, are all about relative rates of growth at different parts of the income distribution. So you can see how the top line just trucks on up until the 1970s and then stabilizes, has a little bit of a downward trend, but it's essentially is fluctuating around a fairly flat trend from the 1970s on. Whereas the bottom line, which is the real incomes of the top 1%, is increasing over time, and then in the 1980s really starts to scoot upwards. So that's what I mean by saying that it's the relative rates of growth of different parts of the income distribution that really drive changing income shares. And you can see that here's the US and Canada making the same point, that the real incomes of the top 1% didn't fall really much of ever, except for very brief periods of time. They just grew slowly until the early 1980s, or the mid-1980s, in the case of Canada. And it's those unequal relative growth rates that cause changing income shares. And the thing is that when you look at, let's go back here. You look at this sort of figure, you might get the impression, well, income inequality was high back in the 1920s, it fell, and now we're coming back to a high inequality. It's kind of like used to be one steady state, then we get to another period of low inequality, now we're going back to another steady state. So you might get the impression that, you know, we're at least going to stabilize at some high level of inequality. But the rising real incomes of the top 1%, there's no particular reason why that process has to stop. There's no particular reason why it can't keep on trucking. And in fact, well, here is another way of summarizing the same data, just looking at it in terms of growth rates at different parts of the distribution, should caution you that the bottom percentiles, or the 20th, 40th, to the 80th percentile are household income data drawn from surveys. The top 99.9 percentile of the income distribution numbers are drawn from the tax data. So they're not quite, their growth rates are comparable. The underlying concept is a little bit differently measured. And key thing to recognize when you look at those high annual growth rates at the very top end of the income distribution is that you've got income growth 4 or 5% per year, compounding year after year after year on what was initially a very high base. So if you think of, if the World Top Income Database enables you to look at what the real income of the top 0.1% of the U.S. was in like 2005, 2006, 2007, it's going up by like from 6.8 million to 7.3 million to 7.9 million, approximately a $500,000 annual increase each and every year, right? And continue to increase it. So that makes a big impact on per capita GDP. If you take the median Canadian household with an income of about $70,000 a year and a long-term average growth rate of around 0.4% per annum, that's about $280 a year increase in GDP. Somebody with $1 million growing at 4% a year, that's adding like $40,000 a year to GDP. So it's not surprising that you can have robust GDP per capita growth if it's all concentrated on high incomes that are compounding up at a high rate. So in that sense, GDP per capita growth rates in Canada and the U.S. have simply been a highly misleading average of stagnancy for the vast majority of the population and very high compound rates of growth at the very top. Okay, so what are the implications of all this? Now, well, let's go back here just for a minute. If we were to stabilize income inequality, the only way in which income inequality can be stabilized is if all those growth rates of income at different parts of the distribution were the same. The only way in which the income distribution can be stable over time is if they're all parts of the incomes at all parts of the distribution are growing at the same rate. Now, if that rate on average is like 2% per year or 3% per year, two questions you might ask yourself. What is it that would pull the bottom 95% of the distribution up to a compound annual growth rate of like 3% per annum, year after year? Or alternatively, you could stabilize by reducing the growth rates of the people at the very top. That too would stabilize the income distribution. So what process might actually reduce the growth rates of income at the very top of the distribution? Absent either an increase at the bottom in growth rates or a decrease at the top in growth rates, the inequality in growth rates will necessarily mean increasing inequality off into the indefinite future. So what does that imply? Well, we're talking about a big difference in growth rates, compounded year over year. 4% for the top 1%, a half a percentage point for the bottom 80%. Can we think of any structural changes in the immediate horizon that would suddenly boost the growth rates of the bottom 80% of the population to a 4% level? We're still talking about continuing high unemployment in the U.S., continuing high youth unemployment, and over 7% unemployment in Canada. Unions are weak. Institutional protections for labor are very poor. Low-wage employment is highly exposed to international competition. Structural change? Well, we've already had urbanization and increasing female labor force participation. Everybody's talking about the importance of education, but we're really talking about marginal changes, marginal improvements from a very well-educated stock of already, right? So we're only talking about increasing in tertiary education for the margin of and the margin of expansion is from a level at which the majority of the 18 to 24 cohort already in post-secondary education. So we've had our structural changes. Now, why would income growth at the top slow? Well, there are many explanations of competing explanations of what's been going on at the top end. Increasing in prevalence of winner-take-all markets, increasing control by the CEOs and top executives over the executive compensation process. Many competing explanations. None of them have any particular reason to slow down. I mean, if the top CEOs have been able to appropriate most of the gains from growth for the last 20 years, why exactly would they stop? If it's returns to rents, to the trademark rents of the Nike swoosh or the Apple computer, which are being marketed now to the world, those trademark rent, those rents grow with the growth of the international marketplace. So why exactly would we expect a sudden deceleration and a dramatic deceleration in the income growth rates pre-tax of the top 1% of the population? But if it continues, we have to face some important issues of accounting. I mean, that's one of the great things about economics. The things do have to add up. We have these accounting identities out there. And so there are general equilibrium effects. Increased income has to be either consumed or saved. There's been a lot of attention paid, and appropriately so, to the monster homes and the excessive ostentatious consumption of the top 1%. But at least that does recycle income. If we expect, and there's good reason to expect, that the marginal propensity to save at the top end is at least positive and probably increasing, then income increases at the top necessarily produced increased savings in aggregate for the economy as a whole. Now, macroeconomic balance requires that real incomes should equal real expenditures in aggregate. So if people at the top are abstaining from consumption, their annual flow of consumption is less than their annual flow of income, then somebody somewhere elsewhere in the system has to be spending in excess of their income. There has to be some excess spending somewhere else in the system if the savings top end are to balance in the system as a whole. So, of course, when the people at the top end save, they typically save not in real physical terms, but in financial terms, by acquiring financial assets. Well, a financial asset has a two-faced characteristic. A financial asset to the owner is an asset. A financial instrument to the owner is an asset. To the issuer, it's a liability. The flip side of increasing wealth at the top end of the income distribution is increasing liabilities in the bottom end of the distribution. Now, Bob Frank also has a whole set of arguments about how consumption norms escalate when inequality increases, when the when you have these high compounding rates of growth of income at the top end, and suddenly it's not enough to have a granite countertop in your kitchen. You got to have granite countertops in both your bathrooms, and of course it's not enough just to have two bathrooms. You got to have ensuite bathrooms and mudrooms and every other thing. That he has quite a nice argument about how norms at the top have set up these expenditure cascades of consumption norms, and in particular when so much of the wealth of the middle class is concentrated in home equity, and then particularly in the U.S. could be monetized for consumption. Now, this sets off expenditure cascades throughout the income distribution. You don't actually need that argument to make the point that the increasing assets of the top 1% have to have their converse in the increasing liabilities of the bottom 99%. Some people have argued that there's been the increase in inequality of consumption in the long term, in the U.S. particularly, has been less than the increase in inequality of income. That people's, and there's a debate about that. If true, the flip side has not really been recognized, that if people's consumption is growing less unequal than their incomes, something must be happening to the distribution of assets and liabilities. Because you can only change your consumption less than your income if you're acquiring assets or issuing liabilities. So the flip side of differential growth rates and the increasing acquisition of financial assets at the top is increasing financial liabilities and increasing debt leverage. And that's a process that as debts mount, and we're seeing this process in Canada, as financial debts mount, but money incomes remain stagnant, that leverage cannot increase without limit. At some point, the house of cards comes crashing down. Financial crises don't just stop there. They generate real economy recessions. Within the real economy, of course, governments, partly because of automatic stabilizers of the system and partly from discretionary countercyclical fiscal policies, step in. So we start to see the power of accounting identities. The idea that your debt in period T is just 1 plus the average interest rate times your debt in the previous period, minus the amount you get to pay back. PB could stand for either primary balance of government or payback. It's kind of convenient. It's just an accounting identity. Divide by income, take the difference, and when you get the second equation, that the change in the debt-to-income ratio depends on the difference between the interest rate and the growth rate multiplied by the debt-to-income ratio of the previous period minus the fraction you get to the primary balance. I think it's a very useful couple of accounting identities, not just relevant to the public sector, relevant to any, to corporations, to households, just an accounting identity. But what it implies is that if the interest rate, if debts are compounding over time, then you become uniquely vulnerable to the difference between interest rates and growth rates. We saw that in action in a big way in Canada in the mid-1990s, in the late 80s, early 90s, when interest rates escalated. It wasn't because of a growth in the primary balance that Canadian governments got into such problems in the early 1990s. It was because the gap between interest rates and growth rates grew quite dramatically, so the debt was compounding at a much faster rate than income was growing. And if we're ever going to put a brake on inflation, then that's good. That's the way that it's going to happen again. Central banks do that. They raise interest rates in order to decrease the growth rate. Well, okay, what's the option then if you have a financial crisis and a collapse in the real economy, escalating expenditures and declining receipts, so the primary balance is increasing and debts are mounting. We can monetize that debt that's another word for quantitative easing, actually, buy it up with cash. If we do that, we keep on doing that? At what point do we stop just printing money to cover government debts? On the other hand, the U.S. Debt to GDP ratio has gone up by like 50 percentage points between 2004 and 2012, and is still increasing and heading for the roof. At current levels, maintaining a primary balance with return to traditional interest rates requires like 2.4% of GDP. That expenditures be the primary balance be like 2%, 0.4% of GDP. What's the point? The point is that we have escalating and interacting instabilities, that the financial crisis produces real crises. The real crises produce crises of public finance. The crises of public finance have to be, in the short term, produce counter-cyclical fiscal flows, which compound into debt stocks, which down the road create new problems for the current fiscal public balance and for any sort of future fiscal policy or monetary policy. So the long-term policy outlook, therefore, is for interacting instabilities, but Mexico is a very different case. What we have here is the growth incidence curve for Mexico, which looks at the percentiles of the income distribution and the growth rate between 1994 and 2006 in incomes at different points in the income distribution. And what you'll see is that growth rate was much higher at the bottom part of the income distribution than at the top. So you don't have this tendency for financial fragility if incomes are growing strongly at the bottom of the income distribution. And why? Because in Mexico, we had a whole series of what you can call structural changes, what other people can call one-time changes. Now, it started in 1995 from an underemployment recession situation. Part of the growth is a recovery, a cyclical recovery. But in addition, there are a lot of structural changes happening in Mexico over the last 30-odd years, which are not so different from the structural changes that Canada and the U.S. went through earlier. If you've got a high percentage of the population engaged in agriculture, you can have a lot of people moving out of rural poverty into the urban sector. Now, sometimes they move into informal urban employment and then later into formal urban employment. But either way, it's a big increase in family incomes. If you've got a low percentage of women employed in the paid labor market, increasing female labor force participation makes a huge difference to household incomes. The process has already been going on for decades in Canada, just starting in Mexico. Relatively low levels of educational attainment in Mexico, meaning you've got very high marginal returns to human capital and lots of people who can benefit from increasing education. We talk all the time in Canada about the importance of education, but we're already a very well-educated society, particularly for younger cohorts. So we're talking about marginal gains for a relatively small percentage of the population. Now, in the Mexican case, capital deepening is also part of the story. That was also true in Canada and the U.S. post-war. And we had a, in Canada, the US, we also had the a demographic surge. Mexico has had that again in the last 30 odd years. Again, once you've got very low birth rates, not much room left to change. In addition to which, the political economy of social policy has got to be important. Mexico has a large and long and very violent history of civil conflict. Canada, I looked up the numbers on the, on, we have like four incidences that I can think of. There was the Riel, the 1837 lower, upper lower Canada rebellions, the Riel rebellions of the 1880s. In Western Canada, we had a Winnipeg general strike and a total of, and then there's Quebec secessionary events. Something like seven people killed in the whole history of Quebec independence movements. A couple in Winnipeg. The big killer was back in the 1837. So our Canada's two-century death toll in civil conflict is significantly less than estimates of the number of people who got killed in the main plaza in Mexico City in 1968 in the demonstrations about the Mexican Olympics. Right? The contrasts in sort of the blood quotient of history are just truly dramatic. My point is that the Mexican elite have good reason to worry about the potential for extra-constitutional change. And 1995 happened to be the year of the Chiapas rebellion in the south of Mexico. So there was a credible hard-left political threat effect that you could argue for. And the Mexican elite responded. The decline of the PRI in Mexico was matched with the expansion of substantial social programs, the Progressive Program, which has had a significant impact on the incomes of the bottom 20-25% of the population. By contrast, what's been happening in Canada, about the same time, we saw the impact of the debt stability equation. We saw that we had the fiscal crisis of the early 1990s, and in Canada's a country where a majority government has a lot of room for maneuver. And in 1995, this plots, the top line is the change in the Gini index of household disposable equivalent income from taxes compared to the Gini index of household disposable income market income. The green line is the impact on the change in the Gini index comparing household disposable money income before taxes, household disposable money income and the impact of transfers. So the top line measures the inequality reducing impact of taxes. The bottom line, the middle line is the impact on inequality of transfers. And the bottom dashed black line is the impact of taxes plus the impact of transfers, or the net impact of government in total. And so the point of putting it up is to note that the impact of taxes on the distribution of income, it's there on inequality, the distribution of income. It's there. It has a little bit of a trend in it, but not much over this period. Where we saw action was in the changing role of the Canadian transfer system. It used to be that you would go to international conferences and you say, "Oh, you're from Canada. The big increase in market income inequality, but you guys have stabilized the dollar out." The Canadian tax transfer mechanism worked to stabilize the distribution of after-tax, after-transfer income up until about 1995. The impact of the Martin cuts in 1995 was to change that transfer component of the system, and to change it to, instead of offsetting, to more accentuating the increase in inequality that's coming from increased market income inequality. So the bottom line, it represents the change in sort of inequality stance, if you will, of the Canadian fiscal system. Up to 1995, working against the tide of increasing inequality, since 1995, if anything, accentuated and stabilizing a bit in the 2000s. So, we haven't seen an attempt of Canadian governments to try to stabilize the distribution of income in Canada. We could, majority governments can change directions, but I'd argue that I don't see any particular likelihood for state and Canada to start thinking about recycling incomes anytime soon. We've had in Canada since the early 70s a national narrative about being the kinder and gentler part of the North American continent. But that's a national myth of relatively recent origin. The U.S. got Social Security back in the 1930s. We had to wait up to the early 1970s to get Canada Pension Plan. So the longer historical trajectory of Canada is more like the colder and harder part of the continent. There's no history of hard left threat. There's no threat effect on elites. And currently, the current political scene certainly sees a conservative majority with, I would argue, as close to zero, absolute zero concern with increasing inequality as is possible to measure. Both in their public pronouncements about, or lack of public, any mention of, the trend, and in their philosophical opposition to anything that could reverse that trend, I can't see any chances I'd say no near-term prospect of a political economy of redistribution and stabilization. So that kind of leaves the U.S. And the question is, what are the chances for a new deal? Back in the 1930s, Franklin Delano Roosevelt kind of saved capitalism from itself. There are a lot of people have focused for a long time on the public works component of the New Deal and have ignored the many other structural reforms that were part of that whole policy package. There was a policy, part of the policy package was to get unions into the tent to recognize collective bargaining and to encourage collective bargaining, which gave a voice to the bottom part of the income distribution. American union density was greater than Canadians well into the 1950s. There's also structural reforms like bank regulation, increase in social securities, a progressive tax system, a whole bunch of mechanisms which, one way and another, tended to improve the growth chances of the bottom end of the income distribution and to recycle income from the top. And that, you could argue, stabilized growth in the, or certainly stabilized growth of different parts of the distribution for the best part of 50 years. It only really got systematically started to be dismantled in the 1980s. And in particular, we've seen a dramatic decline in top marginal income tax rates and a decrease in income recycling from the top. Currently, I'd argue that there are two really big things going on, kind of conflicted attitudes to inequality in the U.S. and the impact of money politics. So the little graph there is taken from an article with Tim Smeeting, where we looked at the attitudes of people in the U.S. and a bunch of other countries to what people should earn and what they do earn. And if you're satisfied with the distribution of income, you'll say that most of the time what people do earn is what they should earn. The ratio between those is one. Almost every other country, there's kind of a unimodal distribution, and it's significantly less than one. Most people, most every part of the world, would like there to be more equality. And there's a variation in attitudes, but there's kind of a common consensus. What the U.S. distribution of attitudes is notable for is its bimodal character. A bunch of people quite satisfied with things as they are, and a very strong group of people very dissatisfied with things as they are. Now, bimodal distribution has the characteristic that it's a bit unstable, that if you shift a few people from one mode to the other, then the majority can tip one way or the other. But on the other hand, the U.S. has this system of balance of powers with dual houses elected on differing terms, of important roles of court decisions. If you can block change for long enough, you can hope that the balance of power will tip back. And of course, we've seen since the Supreme Court decision in the U.S. a few years ago that basically buy whatever you want in terms of political ads, that those who have billions can spend hundreds of millions to get the sort of political change or get the political wind that they want. So the stronger economic political economy feedback loop may well be the idea that increasing economic inequality breeds increasing political inequality through the campaign contribution. So my story up to now isn't really a very happy story. It's a story about how we've had this very fundamental disconnect between growth rates at the very top and growth rates for the vast majority of the population. Now, there isn't, that I can see, any automatic economic tendency for those growth rates to equalize anytime soon. There may have been happy historical accidents in the past when one-time structural changes produced strong growth rates at the bottom in Canada and the U.S., but we shouldn't mistake those happy historical periods for the what we can expect going forward, because they're one-off kind of structural changes. And I don't see any automatic economic tendency for growth rates to equalize at different points in the income distribution. I think the political economy is crucial. Now, of course, one thing that we know is that the unsustainable gets sustained. It doesn't last. What isn't so clear is what follows. Unbalanced income growth does necessarily imply ever-increasing inequality, and that can't be a steady-state equilibrium. I'm arguing that it has multiple instability implications, because increasing income inequality necessarily implies changes in consumption and savings flows, which necessarily compound into changing distributions of assets and liabilities at different points in income distribution. Now, I asked the question, what are the chances for a New Deal? And comparing ourselves with the 1930s, well, we know the world has changed in many, many, many dramatic ways. But one thing that I think remains true, that the political economy of adaptation to systemic instability doesn't have just one answer. In the Europe of the 1930s, we saw the playing out of many political changes in response to great economic instabilities. Some nations made political choices that were disastrous for both for themselves and for many many millions of people, like Germany, of Italy, of Spain. Some countries made political choices which have generated enduring success stories. I'd count those as the Scandinavian social democracies. So my bottom line is that political choices matter.